You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Thank you, Susanna Duffy. You are now listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence with me, Amy. My pronouns are she, her, or they, them. Happy NAIDOC Week. I hope you are enjoying 3CR's Beyond the Bars broadcast. I would like to acknowledge that we are broadcasting to you today from the stolen lands of the Kulin Nation, and I pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. I would also like to extend that respects to any First Nations listeners tuning in today.
No!
My beautiful dog Cassie emphatically agrees. We are talking dangerous ideas today to Western and US imperialism. I think it's interesting to reflect on why the major powers of the world are so threatened by indigenous peoples of the world building their own power, sovereignty, and autonomy. What is so dangerous about their ways of life to the major powers of the world? I believe the original sovereigns of this land actually have a lot of the answers to many of the existential issues we face today. Something to ponder. Got a jam-packed show for you today, so I'm going to play a short version of the show sting. Haven't played this one in a while. May it wake you up from your slumber this morning like needles pricking your skull. Welcome back. We are talking dangerous ideas today that Western and US imperial powers want to squash. Why, you ask? Because the two countries I'm featuring today, Laos and Cuba, do a lot of kill your lawn and kick your fence things. But first, thank you to everyone who has donated to Radiothon. This show has raised $772. Special thanks to everyone who has donated. We still haven't hit that $1,000 target yet though, so if you haven't donated yet, you still can. Even $2 goes a long way to paying our station and funding our meager resources. If you came to the 50th, I hope you had a lovely day. It certainly was an eventful day in NAM activist land. After preparing today's episode and reflecting on the 50th, I've been thinking about how 3CR is all about the we, the community. It's the continuum of we, rather than being about me, me, me. I think many of my favourite shows are, in fact, the shows that have gone throughout the decades with many different hosts contributing to a project bigger than themselves. In fact, if anyone who likes this show wants to join me on this show, I'm always happy to make this a collaborative project. Now, an excellent example of this 3CR continuum is the 3CR breakfast shows. About a year ago, 3CR had the pleasure of Jesse and Nina joining the Wednesday breakfast crew. Jesse did an amazing interview with Associate Professor Holly Hart from Deakin University on Lao. I found this interview so fascinating with amazing examples of community collaboration with an emphasis on the we rather than the me. So let's listen back to that right now.
Not many people really think about Laos much or really know much about Laos in Australia. And I was hoping maybe you could situate where Laos is and geographically and maybe a little bit around the culture and, you know, obviously its neighboring countries and how and where Laos is kind of at now.
Okay, great. So Laos, or the Lao People's Democratic Republic, as it's been known since 1975, is in the heart of Southeast Asia. It's the only landlocked country in Southeast Asia. It's surrounded by China to the north, Myanmar, Thailand, Cambodia, and Vietnam. The people who live there are about 50%, roughly more than half, just a bit more than half the population is ethnic Lao, and they speak a language which is similar to Thai. and they cluster sort of around the Mekong Valley and historically were wet rice farmers in the sort of fertile plains around the river. And up in the highlands to the north and along the border with Vietnam, you get a lot of different ethnic groups, including Austroasiatics, the Hmong, all kinds of, about half the population are split up into small ethnic minorities. So the country has its roots in French Indochina. There was, that's when the sort of idea of Laos that's roughly correlates with the current borders was first conceived of. I guess going back further, there were sort of ancient kingdoms like Lan Xang and that sort of thing. But modern Laos emerged in the colonial and post-colonial era. And so today Laos is, I don't know, a population of about 6 or 7 million and one of the poorest countries of Southeast Asia, but also one that's quickly growing. It's had some of the highest economic growth rates in the region up until COVID. It suffered quite a lot during COVID, not so much because of the pandemic itself. People were quite robust in the face of the pandemic. There weren't a huge amount of deaths and they handled the pandemic very well in terms of rolling out the vaccine and that sort of thing. But the economic fallout from the pandemic has hit the country really hard, especially in terms of devaluing the currency and a lot of inflation related to, I guess, shocks from the international economy, such as when the United States started putting up interest rates that really impacted Laos because a lot of their debts are in foreign currencies and inflation has compounded that. So there's a lot of concern around the economy in Laos at the moment. So that's sort of where we're up to.
Thank you. And I'm hoping we can focus a bit on, or mostly on, the politics in Laos and sort of how that works, and maybe focus on some examples that can sort of point out or exemplify some of the differences, because it is a one-party socialist state, and not, you know, that's kind of a foreign concept, I think, to many of us here in Australia. And there might be a lot of ideas about what that might mean, but also just very curious about what it actually does mean and what it means for people living there. Can you talk a little bit about, you know, how the political framework is designed there, how politics works there for people who are in politics, but also for the people who live in Laos?
Sure. So it's a People's Democratic Republic. So this was the result of a 30-year struggle against first French colonialism and then US intervention. Laos is the most heavily bombed country in the world per capita. A lot of the Ho Chi Minh Trail ran through Lao territory during the war, and there was also a lot of concern about the strategic importance of the Plain of Jars in Laos, which is a big plain to the north. This was the era of the domino theory of communism. The idea was that if China had already fallen to communism and Vietnam North Vietnam had fallen, then Laos would fall and then Thailand would fall. So there was this idea that if they could halt the spread of communism there, that would spread the sort of global, that would stop the global spread of communism. So Laos was just very heavily bombarded. And actually, when there were moratoriums against the bombing in North Vietnam, which were sort of great victories for the peace movement here in Australia and America when they stopped the bombing on North Vietnam, the sad news is that those planes were redirected over Laos. They didn't stop bombing. They just bombed in secret another country. So Laos had a very long, drawn-out struggle, and this was led by Gaysom Pomvihan, who was the military leader of the movement, but also the sort of the leader in political thought, and he was very influenced by Marxist-Leninist ideas. And so he conceived of the struggle as a people's struggle for national independence. And part of this was the decision-making process of democratic centralism. So the idea was that, you know, this is a war for independence. It's, we're not mucking around here, so there has to be centralism. Centralism means when a decision is made, everybody sticks to it. But it also has to be democratic, because what are we fighting for? We're fighting for freedom. We're fighting for independence. So the way we fight the battle has to reflect the values that we're actually fighting for. So what does democracy mean here? Well, for him, democracy meant that everybody has to have a say in decisions. So before a decision is made, there's extensive consultation. And they viewed this as a really important plank of how they won the war. Is that it wasn't a top-down thing. It was a bottom-up movement, mobilizing what they called a people's war, drawing on people's intimate knowledge of landscapes, the way that they knew what the French were doing, and they could inform on that. They could have women carrying babies, they could have children, they could have old people all involved in the movement, contributing either information or rice or transporting things. Everybody could contribute. So that's what they mean by democracy, is it's a mass movement that everybody contributes to, and everybody's valued, and everybody has an opinion that can be listened to and heard in a consultative manner. But then a decision is made, often by vote. And once that decision is made, there is no dissent. Everybody gets behind the decision. Okay, so that's democratic centralism. And you can see how, in the context of a war, a people's war, that is a very effective strategy. And I think that is why Marxist-Leninist movements have so often been the only ones who have successfully fought in these sort of anti-colonial nationalist struggles. So as a philosophy for leading a war, it's fantastic. And then they gained power, and they had to transfer this into a philosophy for leading a nation, a new nation that had suffered incredible setbacks due to bombardment, and then slapped with embargoes, trade embargoes from the United States and Thailand. That's incredible for a landlocked country to have your closest port put a trade embargo on you. So they had economic sanctions. There were also border disputes with Thailand. There was tension with China because of the conflict in Cambodia. So they were very, as soon as they gained independence, they were in a very precarious position. They also had sort of counter-revolutionary movements based in the refugee camps in Thailand and also in Yunnan, China, that were, being supported by foreign powers to try to undermine the new regime. So they were struggling. There was a very tough few years. And in this context, they wanted to start a people's republic based on this concept of democratic centralist decision making. So, again, a mass movement where everybody contributes to decision making, but at the same time, there's a great deal of unity. Once a decision's made, everybody gets behind it, and you're able to sort of draw on the strength of cooperation and mutuality across society. So not constantly divided. Yeah, so you can see in the post-war period, there was a really big emphasis put on unity. So one aspect of this is unity across ethnicities. It's a very ethnic diverse country. So looking at Laos today, you can start to see, some of the effectiveness of this approach of unity, the emphasis put on unity compared to other countries in the region. Laos is more ethnically diverse, sort of statistically speaking, it has more, a higher proportion of small ethnicities as part of its population than Burma does, than Myanmar does. But there is nothing comparable in Laos to what's going on in Burma in terms of ethnic conflicts. The same could be said of Thailand. Thailand's really impacted by ethnic tensions, especially in the south. There's been an ongoing armed conflicts between the Muslim minorities and the Thai majority in the south of Thailand, although I think in the south that's actually the Muslims are the majority. But there's nothing like that in Laos, not these days anyway, not since the the counter-revolutionary movements have dried up. So an emphasis on unity has been really important in the post-war period, and that's the kind of reflection of this emphasis on centralism, so that you have democracy but with a centralist endpoint. You know, so you have an ethnically diverse country that has unity. You have a style of democracy that's based on the concept that in the end you have a unified direction. Yeah. So how does that work in practice? Because, like, when we think about democracy, literally, if you ask a person on the street in Australia, if you ask what is a democratic country, they'll probably say something like, oh, that you have lots of different political parties and lots of different points of view. Right. So in Laos, they don't have lots of different political parties. They have one. And although there are lots of different points of view, in the end, they have, you know, party resolutions, which are, you know, they come from the, they come like to an outside person. It looks like they're just pronounced by the Politburo as this is the resolution. Now everybody has to follow it. So it looks very much like the opposite of what we think democracy is. So how do they have the guts to stand up and call themselves the People's Democratic Republic of Laos? Like, a lot of people coming from overseas just dismiss this as empty rhetoric. It's just ideology. It's just propaganda. But I was lucky enough to do a research project that was funded by the Australian government, a little research agency called the Australian Centre for International Agricultural Research. And they wanted to know why some of their projects that they fund in agricultural research have big policy impact and some have no policy impact at all, because they want to fund projects that actually change the way things are done in Laos for the better in terms of agricultural production. So they asked me as an anthropologist if I had any insight into policy processes in Laos. And so we did. We had a great research team of local anthropologists and also Australian researchers. And we got to do ethnographic research following the formation of a policy document, the forestry policy, the forestry strategy. And we also attended the National Assembly of Laos and watched how people gave political speeches and how they dealt with live issues. And what I learned from that process is, and what I saw people doing, was this sort of consultation. And like, so in the National Assembly, people stand up and give their opinions, right? And which doesn't sound that surprising, but it's not what we think happens in a one-party authoritarian dictatorship. Sorry, you can edit that. So what's going on here? Why do people stand up and spend time giving impassioned speeches on topics if their input has no importance? And same with the forestry strategy. These are strategies that are released every 10 years, and that full 10 years, like, as soon as a strategy is released, basically the consultation process begins again for the next one. Like, there are these sort of meetings at sort of district level, maybe feeding up from the village level to the district level to the provincial level to the national level, and then the strategy is made, and then it goes back down to the other levels for comment, and then these comments are fed back up and it's revised, and then the revised document is trialed, and once it's trialed, you know, feedback is given on the trial document, and there's just all of this consultation. And we started asking people, why is there so much consultation going on? Why do people, you know, willingly sit in these meetings and devote so much time to this? And we came back to this concept of democratic centralism as, you know, the way policies are designed, the way people's input into policy directions is, it's all guided by this concept of democratic centralism. So at this point, I realized I really had to dig into this and try to understand how this, the history of this concept, and also how it had been adopted in the Lao setting. And of course, for anything that's been viable for this long, you know, democratic centralism was something that was first coined, I think, back in, you know, Lenin was not the first one to use it, put it that way. I don't, but he picked it up, and the meaning of it back then was this incredible period in pre-Soviet Russia, I guess, of everybody contributing their thoughts, and there was an era of great debate, and you know, there was this idea that it would be, you know, contrary to the previous regime where people had been, you know, very limited in what they could say or do, that it would be this, that democracy with this sort of very vibrant contribution from all parties, but at the same time moving in a coherent direction under the centralist principle. But this got reinterpreted under Stalinism to be more centralist. And it's been reinterpreted. So, for instance, the international communist movement, what was it, Comintern? By the time this sort of spread to Laos, so democratic centralism became one of the principles of decision making that other Marxist-Leninist movements had to adopt if they wanted to be part of Comintern. So that's how it sort of got exported around the world. But at the same time, it sort of got reinterpreted everywhere, everywhere it went. And I sort of see this, like thinking about how it evolved in Laos, is that it seems to be part of the principle itself, because there are two poles, democracy on the one hand and centralism on the other. At different points of time and in different places, there's a big variety in how much emphasis is put on one or the other. So it becomes quite a flexible concept. So in wartime, you can imagine that there might be a more abundance of centralism, and in times of peace and prosperity, there might be more room for democracy. I thought that, but then when I was reading more about the history of the war in Laos, did you know that at Dien Bien Phu, when they were fighting the French, and it was this huge all-out battle, and the Lao were involved in this, they had some very important roles in this struggle. At one point, General Giap, the leader of the movement, called a halt to everything, and he wrote this in his memoirs of the battle. He said he had to call a halt to the struggle because there were too much emphasis on centralism, and he wanted people to reconnect with the democratic principles.
Wow.
And so, yeah, he said there were rightist tendencies emerging at the battlefront, and by that he meant like people being too like ordering one another around and not being consultative enough. And so he called a halt until people could get more consultative, and then they got back into it. Yeah, so it's sometimes surprising.
Tune in to the Beyond the Bars Prison broadcast during NAIDOC Week 2026. Listen to 3CR each weekday at 11 a.m. from Monday the 6th through to Friday the 10th of July. We'll take you inside six Victorian prisons: Dame Phyllis Frost Centre, Barwon Prison, Fulham Correctional Centre, Loddon Prison, Marganite Correctional Centre, and Western Plains Correctional Centre. There'll be stories, songs, opinions, and poems from the men and women inside while connecting with culture and community. The shows will be live on 3CR 855 on your AM dial, 3CR Digital, and streaming via our website or the Community Radio Plus app. Head to 3cr.org.au/beyondthebars2026 for more information.
This country's black future is a fire.
In 2026, 3CR is celebrating 50 years on air. Help us celebrate 50 years. Subscribe.
And you're listening to 3CR 855 AM on your dial or on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/listen or on the Community Radio Plus app. We are listening to former 3CR Wednesday breakfaster Jesse interview Holly Hart about Laos and how the people of Laos live under socialism and in community. Let's hear some more.
When I observe politics in Laos, I see quite significant differences from Australia. And I think this goes through even to the most minute interactions. Like when we were doing ethnographic research in meetings when we were following the policy, the production of the forestry strategy. We were comparing the rooms where only Lao people were and the room where the foreign people who had been invited, like, you know, other people who were involved in forestry, whether they be international business owners or working development agencies around forestry, they were sort of in the English-speaking room.
Interesting.
Yeah, and just the differences in how people carried themselves, how they interacted, was very striking. In the English-speaking room, people had quite a that was a cacophony. Like, everybody was talking and presenting their views from where they came from, and the person running the room said, you know, it's my job to, this is democratic centralism. He said, it's my job to provide a summary of all of our views at the end, which can feed into the consultation process. And he said, I actually don't know how to make a summary from all the different things that have been said today. There is no common thread. It's just like a whole bunch of different views. And the people in the English speaking room still have no problem with that. Like, they were just like, yeah, we're all different. whereas in the Lao room, where I was observing, I saw people were very quiet. Like, for a long time, people wouldn't say anything at all. And then when somebody did say something, this was really listened to and received by other people. And then the next person who spoke would try and build on that. And then at the end, everybody was very mindful that they had to produce a summary at the end that they could all agree on, or that they didn't, at least didn't dissent too much. And so they were all helping the leader of the room to create a summary because they knew that was the target of the meeting. Whereas I feel the people in the English speaking room had no idea, or no real, hadn't really grasped the importance of the summary at the end. So it's like, where we come from, we understand the bit where everybody present their opinions, but we don't have the centralist bit where at the end you have to all agree on something.
So,
and you could see the frustration from the person trying to run the English speaking room. They were like, the process doesn't actually work. Like, it's great that you all presented your opinions, but it doesn't actually lead anywhere if we can't make a summary at the end that draws that together. And then,
yeah, that's so interesting.
Yeah. And then that the Lao word for summary, salup, I was just like, my brain was just going, oh my God, because I've sat in so many meetings in Laos. And for like my PhD research was on basically attending meetings in Laos in a village setting. And at the end of every meeting, they have salup, 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 salup. And it's almost, and when I say, so this means summary. And at the end, like when I did my research, my PhD research, I saw this as a kind of ritual thing. Like, we all knew the end of the meeting was coming when someone said, salup, like, okay, summarize. But then when I was observing it at this high level in the city, where they still do the summary, and I saw just how important it was, like the point of the meeting is to make the summary. And that's the bit which then feeds into the next stage of the consultation and the next stage and the next stage. Mm-hmm. So that really was a light bulb moment for me, that I realized these weren't just rituals. This was a small part of a much bigger political philosophy about how you can have both. You know, it's not one or the other. You can have everybody giving their varied opinions, but you can also have unity. You can have democracy and you can have centralism. It's not one or the other. It's sort of a shuttling back and forth between them, even in the space of a one-hour meeting. You have a bit of this and a bit of that. Yeah.
Well, we don't have this idea of that we're in this together. And, of course, that famous Thatcher quote of there's no such thing as society comes to mind. And I feel like that very much as that quote is ridiculous, it does have some truth to it in the way that our society is developed and designed, and from all of our institutions, whether that's education or political institutions. So that's how I can kind of conceive of that in what you've just described in to the experience of, you know, growing up in Australia.
Can I build on that? I love that you thought about that quote, there is no such thing as society, because I think the thing that I've learned from watching Laos for so long, and over so many big and unexpected things, like especially COVID, I think what I learned is that there is no such thing as society unless you build it, you know, and that's the difference. Like society is an incredibly strong and resilient and amazing thing, but it doesn't come from nowhere. It comes from all these daily interactions and practice and experience, putting up with the frustrations of dealing with other people. And I think in Australia, we've starved our society. We've starved those social capacities. And then when it really comes to the crunch, like something like COVID, it's not there. But in Laos, in 2002, I went to all these meetings and I was like, what the hell are these people doing? Like, they would have a day where every single household would have to send someone to the school to clean up the school grounds and repair the fence. And I would be like, good anthropologist, taking photos, taking notes, talking to people. Then another day, they'd have a day where everybody would have to send someone to work on the pathways, sweeping the pathways, cleaning the pathways. They even do this in the city. If you're in Laos, sometimes you'll be lucky enough to just see a whole bunch of people with hats on out just picking up rubbish together, because everybody in Laos lives in a village. It's the smallest level of administration. Even if you live in the cities are broken up into districts and villages, and you will at some point have to work with your village to do something like this. Okay, and so I was looking at this thinking, what is the bloody point of all of this? Like, these leaves are going to blow back on the path, and, you know, why are they doing this? But then when something like COVID came along, these people knew who their village was. Do you know what I mean? And they knew how to work together. They'd worked together before. Mm-hmm. And so when push came to shove, they were able to act pretty much independently of the state to secure their own local biosecurity. It was really inspiring because, like, because I live in a village that's, you know, at the moment I live in a village in rural Victoria, roughly the same size as a lot of the villages I work with in Laos. And the contrast was just stark. Like, here in Australia, I was not able to send my children to school, even though we're a tiny village, because we couldn't be sure that people wouldn't drive down from Melbourne and spread the virus locally. Whereas in Laos, when I spoke to my friends over there, when we reconnected after COVID, which was such a special time to see them again, and I said, how did you go during COVID? And they said, oh, you know, we just got together and we said, okay, all the old people stay in the village. And if we want to buy food from outside, one person will go. We'll give this person our order and our money. They can go and get the food. They can be in quarantine for a few days when they come back. Our kids continue to go to school because the school teacher lives locally. They basically had no interruption to their daily life, except their interactions outside the village were smaller. But in terms of them continuing to do their main professions, in terms of continuing to send their kids to school, it was all uninterrupted. And the reason they were able to just even have those conversations is because they have those local networks that are built up through this very conscious effort that the Lao government has to build local capacity, to build strength in society at a local what they call the grassroots level.
That's incredible, and that example is very powerful, I think, for people in Melbourne especially, when we endured lots of lockdowns and a lot of mismanagement from government in terms of getting vaccines and the whole affairs with the quarantines, but of course also the complete shutdown of the public housing towers, which was horrific. To contrast those experiences, I think is especially powerful and speaks to, even if we're thinking about things in economic terms, like that's amazing. Like, it sounds like the Laos economy was able to really withstand, you know, this COVID event, without too much change or too much disruption.
Well, not so much the economy. I mean, the economy got shattered, but the social impact, you know, in terms of people's emotional well-being, in terms of the continued education of children, the well-being of elderly people, that was all a lot stronger in Laos, I think. I'll give you another example. When I went up to another village I do field work in, it's very small up in the remote mountains, so I can only go there when it's possible. They only just got a road, so I went last year. So I went on the road last year to see these people. I hadn't seen them for like 10 years. And it's a village of maybe 150 people. And they had built, I asked them what they did during COVID, and they said, oh, we just used our old, our old traditions of galum, which means taboo. So we just declared the whole village taboo. So nobody was allowed out and nobody was allowed in. And they showed me these, they'd carved these figures out of wood and placed them along the main footpath. At that time there was no road, so it was just a footpath to get into the village. And they said that was to communicate to, it was probably about 20 of these posts that were like carved like soldiers and other scary figures. And that was to communicate to anyone approaching that they weren't to come in. And that happened across Laos, like people reactivated these traditions that they had of around sickness as taboo, to just sort of like, so you might have seen when you go to Southeast Asia, bamboo skewers folded into the shape of a star. They're called daleo. They're in the north of Laos. So a lot of people put daleo around their villages or houses to just, so yeah, so that I think in the history of humanity, including in Laos, you can find examples of the way people operated at a local level to have a sense of we, you know, we do this together, we act collectively. And I think in the contemporary world, people still have in some places those traditions, and that there are also approaches to government and policy which can foster and enhance a sense of we. But I think in some countries, including Australia, maybe England, a lot of Europe and America, this sense of we has been undermined, or at least not fostered, not supported. And so what people looked for in that vacuum, I guess, is, ironically enough, government intervention. And I say it's ironic because when we think of a place like Laos, like when most people's idea of a one-party state is that you have this centralized government that's telling everyone what to do. And I see almost the opposite. I see, because they've invested so much in community and a local sense of we, people actually, the government often feels very distant there, and people don't look to the government first to solve their problems, put it that way. I wrote an article called It Wasn't the Government That Did It, It was Us. And it's an article about how this other village, a third village that I haven't spoken about yet, how they solved the problem of getting clean water, because they'd moved from a very remote area to a lowlands area because they were hoping to engage more with the economy, better schools, better hospitals, but it didn't have clean water. And so a lot of people got sick, a lot of people died. It was a big crisis. It was awful. But when I heard the story, it was told to me with a lot of pride, because in the end, the solution that worked was raising some money locally from amongst the various households to buy a clean spring, working like commissioning labor from a group of houses to do the labor of digging it out and putting charcoal in and filters and stuff and putting pipes in. And now every year, some guys from the, well, four times a year, someone walks around the village and collects money from people, and this goes towards the upkeep. And the person who organized it was really proud of it. He was saying, yeah, like, you know, all these people tried to help, like the health office, the government, NGOs, international organizations, but the solution that worked was when we did it. And, you know, he told me this story with a big smile. And it could be a story that was written as this horrible tragedy of how all these people died because they were resettled and there wasn't adequate water and stuff. But the story he wanted to tell was, we solved this problem ourselves. And I'm struck with the contrast here in Australia when I'm just looking at how social problems get solved. Again and again, people here just look to the government. And I find that quite ironic, because Laos is meant to be the one-party totalitarian state. But I actually see everyday people there have a lot more of an independent mindset in terms of solving problems themselves, working locally to sort out their own issues. And also I feel there's a lot of pushback when the state does try to act in Laos. They often receive a lot of pushback from everyday people. So it's maybe not the monolithic sort of scary place that people visiting tourists often think it is when they go to Laos. Yeah.
Did you know that Western Sahara is Africa's last colony? The issue of Western Sahara was raised in the Eddie Mabo case referencing Terra Nullius. Western Sahara is illegally occupied by Morocco. Indigenous Sahrawis are denied their right to self-determination. France continues to veto United Nations human rights observation in Western Sahara. Sahrawi people are being killed by Israeli drones. Like to learn more? Become informed. Become an Australia Western Sahara Association member at awsa.org.au. Australian Western Sahara Association is a 3CR supporter.
International Bookshop's Big Red Book Fair is back for 2026. We'll have thousands of secondhand books for super low prices and 20% off new books, plus many other cool things. This is a great moment to support Melbourne's longest running left bookshop. I'll see you on Saturday, the 18th of July from 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. at Trades Hall, 54 Victoria Street, Carlton. Can't wait to see you there. The new International Bookshop is a 3CR supporter.
No, you're not listening to Wednesday Breakfast. You're listening to Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence on 3CR 855 AM on your dial, on the 3CR website at 3cr.org.au/listen, or on the Community Radio Plus app. Or maybe you've podcasted the show. You can even boycott the corporate platforms by going direct to the 3CR website, where you see little blog posts accompanying the episodes, sometimes even with pictures. I will, in fact, leave the complete interview between Jesse and Holly on the podcast page for this episode. So I've been wanting to make an episode about Cuba and the incredible resilience of its people for some time. They have developed so many communal ways of surviving decades of economic sanctions, but I think today it's more important to draw attention to the current crisis unfolding brought about by the Trump government. I think it's really important to understand that what the US fears the most is the idea Cuba represents. It fears any left-wing, anti-imperialist, anti-capitalist government. Their ideas of equity and peace are fundamentally opposed to the modus operandi of the United States, which is a quote-unquote global rules-based order where the United States is the major power with its small capitalist class reaping the profits. Who profits from the madness led by the US and Israel in West Asia? The weapons merchants, the traders in death. Whose imperialism comes out on top globally by so-called conquering the Strait of Hormuz? The United States government. It's pretty disgusting for a government to make his wealth in death and suffering. So we are now going to listen to 3CR legend Marie Delora from last weekend's Humanitarian Half Hour speaking about the dire situation in Cuba right now. You can also catch Marie on the Latin American Update and on Radio Filef. If you want to support Cuba, you can reach out to Marie and the good folk at the Melbourne Australia Cuba Friendship Society at www.melbourneacfs.org. And I believe there are other branches in other states. Let's hear from Marie.
Lovely to see everybody here today. As you know, Cuba is an island nation, 10 million people, used to be 11, but almost a million people have left because of the terrible situation. 150 kilometres from Key West in Florida, United States, in the Caribbean, incredible warm tropical area. The Trump administration of the United States is currently doing everything in its power to strangulate Cuba. causing hunger and hardship. And they're thinking up devious ways to escalate the torture of the Cuban people. And as you know, sanctions kill people. So since January 29th this year, President Trump has been conducting a siege on Cuba. It clearly violates international law. Humanitarian consequences are starkly visible. We've seen the collapse of the power grid, water scarcity, failing hospitals, and shortages of food and basic necessities. Hunger is spreading. The Geneva Conventions of 1949 explicitly prohibit starving civilians as a method of warfare. Inflicting suffering and hardship as a collective punishment is a war crime. Cuba is facing one of the most dangerous moments it's ever faced. President Trump has issued regular threats against Cuba. You've probably heard them in the mainstream media. He has said, "I think I could do anything I want with it. They're a very weakened nation." Well, if Cuba is at all weakened, it's been done by the United States. He's also said, "I will take Cuba and Cuba is next," and a whole string of other threats of that nature. The mainstream media mostly ignores the hardship and hunger going on in Cuba. What's happening in Cuba, it's not a national disaster like an earthquake or a tsunami. It is deliberately caused by people in the United States in order to destabilise Cuba and bring about so-called regime change. British MP Jeremy Corbyn recently visited Cuba. He stated, "Forever seared in my memory is the sadness in the eyes of the hospital director as he tried to deal with the catastrophic loss of power and lack of medicine." Another UK MP, Steve Witherden, who visited Cuba in May this year, he said that he saw nurses manually pumping ventilators so sick babies could breathe and plastic carrier bags being used instead of colostomy bags. A Cuban surgeon stated that you can't conduct cardiac surgery using a generator, which they tried to do, because generators cut out, and that means that the heart machine doesn't work anymore. He also stated that surgeons often have to use the lights on their mobile phones to complete operations when the power cuts out. As you can see, the lack of power is a tremendous issue in Cuba. There's currently a backlog in Cuba of approximately 90,000 needed operations, and over a million Cubans are without reliable drinking water due to the impossibility of pumping it to homes. You can't pump water into people's homes if you have no oil. United Nations experts have used the term energy starvation to describe what's happening in Cuba. You would think that UNICEF or World Emergency Response Units or teams would be operating to save Cuban children. You would expect that. Why are some lives more valuable than others? Fuel shortages mean that even if there were humanitarian aid available in some regions of Cuba, it would be very difficult to deliver it from one place to another because you've got no oil, you can't send trucks or any kind of delivery transportation. President Trump, together with Secretary of State Marco Rubio, have announced more and more devious and cruel ways to damage Cuba. Their most recent attack involves drawing up lists of people, Cuban leaders and bureaucrats and workers, who are called sanctioned people. Several members of the Cuban organisation promoting friendship with other countries, some of whom have come to Australia on visits that we have sponsored, have been nominated as sanctioned persons. These people have never been accused of any crime or tried or shown to be guilty of anything. It seems the United States can nominate anyone in the world as a sanctioned person without any proof or case against that person. Several airlines have suspended flights into Cuba. Air Canada, Iberia, Air France, and Turkish Airlines have all stopped flights into Cuba due to severe aviation fuel shortages, so they're afraid they won't have fuel. Of course, they could get around it. Airlines that continue to operate into Cuba have to carry extra fuel on their outbound flights or make fuel stops in nearby countries. So you have to make extra special arrangements if you want to fly to Cuba. So it's easy to say, "Oh no, we're going to suspend till the end of the year." There is also a form of online warfare going on. I don't know if you've noticed this, but if you post anything positive about Cuba, or if anybody does in social media, immediately bots and trolls, thousands of them, will come out and you'll find strings and strings of negative comments about whatever you've written, denigrating Cuba, and you'll always find words such as dictatorship, failed state, Castro must go. It's clearly not human beings doing all of it because it appears so quickly and it's so repetitive. But of course, somebody is paying for this algorithm to send all this information, and it makes it look as if Cubans all over the world, exiled Cubans and people, are horrified with what's happening in Cuba, all of which is purely got together by this algorithm that sends out the information. Of course, there are people who would put that online, but it's not nearly as widespread and constantly happening as it does happen with all these bots and trolls. Well, the United States has a war going on both Palestine and Iran, but it also has a war on Cuba using different weapons. Starvation, lack of clean water, food, and lack of medical supplies. That is war, just in a different way. Sadly, many countries are intimidated by United States' threats of penalties and tariffs. Many are afraid to send oil or even humanitarian aid. Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum was sending regular fuel to Cuba. She has stopped completely for fear of penalties and sanctions by the United States. Colombia has sent humanitarian aid in the sense of medical supplies and food, but they're too afraid to send oil as well. The last oil shipment that went to Cuba since December last year went in the Russian ship Anatoly Kolodkin. They delivered 100,000 tonnes of oil to Cuba. I'm not sure how they managed to break the blockade, because there are warships in the Caribbean around Cuba as well. But that ship arrived in Cuba, which of course was very heartening for the Cuban people to receive oil and to be able to turn the lights on for a little while, but that is a temporary solution. As I said, Cuba, like Australia, relies on imported oil. You can remember how upset everybody in Australia got just when the price of petrol went up. That is the horrible circumstance Australian drivers faced, that they had to pay more compared with what's happening in Cuba. There's just no proportional way of looking at it because it's so much worse. Currently, US military surveillance flights are exerting further pressure on Cuba. You can imagine constant flights. And the USS Nimitz carrier strike group is sailing in the Caribbean as a further show of force around the coast of Cuba, to intimidate Cubans, clearly. So all of that leaves Cuba in a very difficult situation. So how can all this be justified? Cuba is an extremely peaceful country that has offered humanitarian aid to countries all over the world. Cuban literacy educators have worked with First Nations people in remote areas of Australia. You might remember we had a talk about this here a while ago, in Wilcannia, Angonia and Bourke, Cuban literacy educators using an incredible literacy program devised in Cuba had great success with First Nations people. Cuban medical teams saved hundreds of lives. The last time there was, you remember the last Ebola outbreak, there's a new one now, but in 2014 in West Africa and Sierra Leone, Cubans saved many lives, and many of their doctors risked their lives because Ebola is a terrible, frightening disease. Cuban doctors saved lives in Pakistan after a disastrous earthquake. And as we speak, Cuban medical teams are tending to Venezuelans who've been injured or are trapped under rubble as a result of two strong earthquakes that happened in the last few days. Of course, once again, funded bots and trolls are sneering at Cuban doctors' motives. And if you look online, they're saying that, yes, they just showed up for a photo opportunity in Venezuela, which, of course, is totally false. The truth of the matter is that Cuban medical teams were already in Venezuela and they simply got up in the morning and went to try and help with the people stuck under the rubble, people who've been terribly injured. But, of course, they can't be given credit for that, because anything positive about what they do is not acceptable. In 2020, more than 50 Cuban doctors risked their lives in Lombardy in Italy. There's a big region of Italy where Cuba is very popular because they were fighting COVID-19, and Italians were very moved by the fact that these Cuban doctors were prepared to go there. Once again, you're risking your life. No one knew what was happening with COVID back then, and people were being infected and dying. And the people of the Lombardy region were so moved that they nominated Cuban doctors for the Nobel Peace Prize. Of course, they didn't win because the right-wing Venezuelan leader won. But that's how strongly the people in Lombardy, probably Lombardia, felt about Cuban medical assistance. In 2025, over 60 countries testified before the United Nations Human Rights Commission confirming the millions of lives saved by Cuban health practitioners around the world. A new set of United States laws now imposes sanctions on government officials in countries hosting Cuban doctors. So if you're a Jamaican leader and invite Cuban doctors, you will not be allowed to have a US visa. You'll be sanctioned in any way the United States can think of for your activities because Cuba has been declared to be a threat to the national security of the United States. So 10 countries have already ended their medical agreements with Cuba. And of course, part of those medical agreements were the doctors themselves are paid and part of the payments go to help the rest of Cuba. So that undermines the Cuban system as well. So by punishing any government official that brings in Cuban doctors, the very poorest and most vulnerable of the citizens in that country, and they're all developing countries, leaves them without health care. And of course, as I said, the income that was going to Cuba is also lost. A Cuban doctor currently working in Calabria, so they're still in Calabria. The United States has been pressuring to get them out of there, but they are still working in Calabria and being paid because they're so popular and they're invited. A Cuban doctor stated just this week, "We haven't left yet, but patients are already worried about what will happen when we do. We work from the heart. We work thinking of helping others, and we give our all every day to the Italian people." So Italian people are worried that they will lose their medical support. Seems the United States is afraid of the threat of a good example. There's a book that was written about Nicaragua way back in the 80s called The Threat of a Good Example. In Cuba, healthcare, scientific training and empathetic health workers offer an alternative to systems that are purely for profit. You might be thinking, why are there such strong attacks on Cuba and not on China or Vietnam? Because the United States trades freely with China, Vietnam, countries with similar socialist approaches. But some of the reasons seem to be, first of all, Cuba is so close to the United States, they find it unbearable to have such a good example 150 kilometres away. Secondly, there are a lot of extreme right-wing Cubans living in Miami, and they have become very powerful and very influential in the government of the United States. There are members of Congress and all kinds of senators who are from Cuban families. And it seems also that Donald Trump, putting forward that the whole of Latin America is a sphere of influence for the United States and pretty much belongs to the United States. He was online last week boasting that he caused the president of Colombia to currently be an extreme right-wing person because there was an alternative and quite progressive candidate, Iván Cepeda, who was looking as if he might win the elections in Colombia. And a lot of people had a lot of hope that change would come, that there would be change. But no, Donald Trump announced that he strongly supported the alternative, De La Espriella, and goodness knows he managed to win the election. So it seems as if the whole of Latin America is seen by the Trump administration as their area of influence, a bit like the Monroe Doctrine years ago. He even said himself, we've got a new Donroe Doctrine. He seems to like to put his name on things. One clear example of the utter hypocrisy of this administration in the United States can be seen in a comment made by Secretary of State Marco Rubio. He said, he was talking about Iran, and he said, controlling the Strait of Hormuz is illegal, an outrage, unacceptable, and a violation of international law. And yet, this reveals the total hypocrisy of the US regime. They themselves are blocking the Caribbean Sea around Cuba, creating a total state of siege so that many other countries are too intimidated to try and send any oil there, preventing any kind of humanitarian aid and sending warships and further warships and drones onto Cuba, which is very much what they're criticising Iran for doing in blocking the Strait of Hormuz. So absolute hypocrisy, as you can see. The good news is that people all over the world are offering solidarity. There are people in countries as far dispersed as Sri Lanka, Malaysia, Ireland, Spain, South Africa, Angola, Mozambique. There's a strong Cuba Solidarity Committee in the UK and France and so on. You can number the countries, but a lot of them...
And you've just been listening to Marie Delora speaking on Humanitarian Half Hour about the dire situation in Cuba at the moment. I look forward to doing a special episode on Cuba at some point in the future and how they've grown their own food, medicine, and survived these harsh economic sanctions for decades. You can learn more about the situation in Cuba by heading to www.melbourneacfs.org, which is the Melbourne branch of the Australia-Cuba Friendship Society. I will also leave a link to the complete talk, including a reading about Cuba, that the Humanitarian Half Hour broadcasted, in today's show notes. I haven't forgotten about the promised cool stuff segment from last episode. It will be featured next episode. Stay tuned for Think Again. You can follow this show, Kill Your Lawn and Kick Your Fence, at 3cr.org.au/killyourlawn, or by giving me a follow on that terrible evil platform, Instagram, at 3cr_kill_your_lawn. Until next time, take care and see you soon.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.